Hello and welcome to the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're asking a question that's diverted investors to a greater or lesser degree over the past couple of years. Are cryptocurrencies money? The attention received by virtual currencies of late has tracked pretty much in line with prices, which surged through 2017 and fell back by as much as 70%. Today, we explore the status of crypto, asking about its potential viability as asset class, tracking the volatility that remains one of its principal limitations, and considering possible regulatory and structural changes that could shape the future of this fast-evolving space. We start with Joni Tevez, precious metal strategist at UBS and a co-author of a recent global macro strategy report from UBS entitled "Are Cryptocurrencies Money and or a New Asset Class?" Joni Tevez, why are you and your colleagues asking this question, and why now?
So over the past year or so, we have been receiving more and more questions on the subject around cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in particular. So we thought that we could address some of these questions in this educational piece. Based on our analysis, in its current form, Bitcoin is still too unstable and limited to be considered money or a viable means of payment for global transactions. There are limitations in terms of on the technical side, and also the level of price volatility tends to be a key consideration here as well.
And why the focus, Joni Tevez, on Bitcoin in particular?
Our objective is to cover cryptocurrencies in general, but we decided to start off on Bitcoin given that it is the largest and most well-known, having first mover advantage. So looking at, for instance, the top five largest known virtual currencies, Bitcoin actually accounts for about 60% of that in terms of market cap. So we thought that Bitcoin would be a good starting point to build a framework, which hopefully we can then apply to others further on.
So what are the main findings then, Joni Tevez? I gather the volatility in Bitcoin prices means it's not a viable asset class yet, in your view. What can you tell us about that? And what are some of the main takeaways of the piece?
Bitcoin structure, so going back to technical limitations, as well as the high price volatility, the key factors why Bitcoin remains unstable and limited to be considered money or a viable asset class. Other factors to consider include regulatory support as well.
So that was Joni Tevez's take on the question of whether crypto is currency. Let's bring in John Dietrich here to get another perspective on that. John is the future finance reporter for Quartz here in London. So, John Dietrich, are cryptocurrencies money in your view?
If you listen to the likes of Bank of England Governor Mark Carney, cryptos are not money. They don't fulfill some of the basic properties, which is, for one, just holding value. They've been too volatile. And if you look around, they're just not being widely used for payments. Stripe, a really important electronic payment processor, dropped support for Bitcoin not long ago because it just simply wasn't used. So far, cryptos have not become a typical widely used means of payment. And it seems that central bankers don't expect them to anytime soon.
There's a broader skepticism about the sustainability of the current universe, if you like, of these currencies in many quarters. John Dietrich, that's understandable, I guess, to some degree, given the cynicism that can greet new technologies, particularly those that are or seem to be disruptive. Is it a case, John, of getting, I don't know, central banks, governments, if not on side, then more engaged with this to change that?
You could make the argument that if you believe that Bitcoin was supposed to take the place of the traditional financial system, then of course central bankers would be skeptical of them. These cryptos, at the most extreme radical ideology, are trying to displace the central banks. But at the same time, the central bankers seem to make very good points. The volatility just is too severe for it to become, so far, to act like actual money. And at the same time, the best use case that has emerged really has been speculation. That's mainly what cryptos have been used for, just betting on whether it'll increase in value or drop in value. And it's more like a lottery ticket, hoping to get rich. Another use case that's emerged is obviously it's being used by some criminals for money laundering and to move money around. Obviously, fiat money can be used for this too, but that has been one use case as well. A third, more promising use case, though, perhaps, is in countries like Venezuela or Turkey, places where the currencies are collapsing, where the monetary system has collapsed. And oftentimes you see people in those countries embrace crypto because even though crypto is volatile, it's not necessarily as volatile as a collapsing monetary regime.
John Dietrich. Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll hear from one of the key people in UBS's team performing research and development into blockchain here in London. Now, Pete Stevens runs UBS's team performing research and development into blockchain and distributed ledger technology based at Level 39, the technology accelerator based in London's Canary Wharf. Pete Stevens, up first, can you tell us a bit about your work day to day and maybe tell us more about some of the trends that you track with your colleagues?
So our team performs research and development into blockchain and distributed ledger technology for all of the different business groups across UBS. We, at a basic level, sort of monitor the market and see what's going on. We provide internal awareness and education, but we also hands-on run both experiments and more tangible projects that aim to develop blockchain solutions that could not only benefit UBS, but the broader market as a whole, because it's a network technology. It's not something you can just deliver for a single organization. They only get the value of these solutions when you have multiple participants taking part. It's very much in its sort of early stages of experimentation still. So research is quite a key part for us. Some of our key themes that we're looking at the moment are things like the emergence of digital assets and the tokenization of capital markets. We're also very interested in the whole space of machine-to-machine payments and the growing machine economy and Internet of Things. There's also the thing around key management and the actual custody of these digital assets, and the overall impact of blockchain technology on financial market infrastructure. And then on the human side, the ability to have digital identity and privacy and being able to combat fraud and money laundering. So those are some of the sort of key themes that I think our group is focusing on at the moment.
Now let's come back and talk about virtual currencies, Pete. Maybe let's start by talking about definitions in this space. Well, are there any, Pete, I guess is my question.
There's very little consensus on formal definitions in the whole blockchain space because it's quite an emerging area with a lot of experimentation going on. Things are moving very fast. So whenever you think you have a good definition, you find that something new comes along and spoils the definition. But to talk about virtual currencies, I think the best way to describe it is to sort of say it's a digital representation of value that has some of the characteristics of money, which would list out as things like being a medium of exchange, a unit of account, a store of value. And while they're generally accepted within a specific community of users, they're not issued or governed or guaranteed by any government. So they're the sort of things that could be a broad range, everything from sort of loyalty points and air miles all the way through to cryptocurrencies.
Defining distributed ledger technology, does that have any more consensus, Pete Stevens, about what it offers, about what it means?
Distributed ledger technology is often used synonymously with the word blockchain. And what they're generally used to describe is a sort of group of technologies that were inspired by the design of Bitcoin. But the terms are really used very loosely and have been associated with everything from sort of public anarchic cryptocurrencies all the way through to sort of private networks supporting regulated business workflows in financial markets. What they usually refer to in general is a shared ledger of transactions that's made possible by a peer-to-peer network of computers and cryptographic infrastructure.
Looking specifically at Bitcoin, it's perhaps expedient to zero in on that cryptocurrency specifically. Can you tell us more, Pete Stevens, about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is quite often seen as the foundation of this whole emerging area of tech. It was launched in 2009, so it's not even had its 10th birthday yet. And it was very much started as an experiment to try and create a computer network that provided sort of electronic peer-to-peer cash. So really what that meant was it was trying to provide a mechanism for anyone in the world to be able to exchange value over the internet without necessarily knowing or trusting each other and without the need to rely on third parties such as banks and without being able to be censored by any regulators, law enforcement or governments. As the experiment sort of moved on and gained more attention, it started to become clear that sort of Bitcoin in its current form was going to struggle to act as widespread money largely due to scalability issues. And it started to get more interest as a sort of new digital asset class. Because of its scarcity concept, people started to describe it as sort of digital gold. And we've started to see a number of businesses providing services around the trading of cryptocurrencies, such as exchanges and safekeeping and stuff like that, and the ability to try and create financial products that are linked to the price of cryptocurrencies that don't actually require somebody to hold the raw digital asset.
Pete Stevens. Let's talk now a bit more about regulation of and in this space. John Dietrich, back to you. Does the regulatory landscape or framework need to change here? Is it even feasible pondering regulatory measures for cryptocurrencies?
It is feasible, and that's certainly something that the market appears to be moving toward. You also see people who are in this industry, in the nascent crypto industry, who are calling for it, who would like to see laws and regulations. More entrepreneurs would perhaps be comfortable coming up with products and services for crypto if they knew exactly what the laws and regulations were. So there is a move toward that. And if you believe that, you know, that there's too much potential manipulation, that there's too much potential fraud, the more you get these watchdog authorities moving in there, perhaps that could move away some of that activity, and perhaps also bring in some more stability as you attract bigger, more stable players to this industry.
And John Dietrich, can you talk a little about the possibility of future endorsements of cryptocurrencies, or of the endorsement of the architecture of Bitcoin, for example, by maybe governments? Could we see that happen? Will we?
That's one of the most exciting use cases, that central banks are looking at the architecture behind cryptocurrencies. One of the most well-known is the Bank of Sweden, because their economy is quickly going cashless and they're looking for ways to evolve their monetary system. Right now, if you have electronic money, it's in a bank account. Whereas with physical cash, you can take money away from a bank and you can hold it personally. Maybe when we get into a cashless world, central banks will want citizens to still be able to do that. You wouldn't want to hold all of your money in your cell phone, for example. There would be the same risk that you have with cash, that it could be stolen, your house burns down, you lose all your savings. But you might want to be able to move some money personally, just as you can with cryptocurrencies. They're far from actually implementing this, but it is something that central banks are looking at, trying to learn from, and studying, because there could be something there. Another thing that has come up, a Bank of England official said not too long ago, he admired the redundancy that's built in within Bitcoin. It's very stable in terms of its architecture and the ledger for checking transactions. It can be a bit slow and expensive and unwieldy, but at the same time, it's also very robust in some respects, even though the price isn't. And so central banks have looked at this as a possible model for the future.
And if we're looking at regulatory support, I wonder, Joni Tevers, if we can come back to you, is that a factor if we think about what could potentially make Bitcoin a feasible payment mechanism?
There are a lot of factors to consider here, but the two key factors that we focused on in the note is scalability and regulatory support. So first on scalability, it basically just means that the structure needs to be able to accommodate the same level of transactions that, say, more established payment systems already process on a day-to-day basis, which currently, because of Bitcoin structure, it is not able to do. Second is regulatory support. So there needs to be a more standardized, let's say, definition of terms globally, more clarity on whose jurisdiction these space falls under, as well as consumer safeguards. These are just some of the things that we've identified. And I suppose dynamism in the regulation as well, as these things tend to be moving quite quickly.
Finally on the program, we'll come to you, Pete Stevens, again. You talked earlier about tracking the market with your colleagues. What is happening out there? What does that tell us about the longer term, potentially?
Some of the major trends that we see that are particularly impactful to us at UBS is that, you know, after we've had a couple of years of sort of deep research and experimentation into this space, but we're now starting to see both financial institutions and new entrants, technology entrants, are really starting to run live trials on blockchain in the capital market space, which is getting very interesting. We're also starting to see that all of the global technology giants are becoming increasingly active in the blockchain space. They're not only exploring how to create commercial products, but they're also exploring how to use the technology for their own use. And we're starting to see a bit of a blurring of the boundary between the two worlds that have been quite divided, the sort of cryptocurrency world and the more traditional financial markets of using sort of blockchain technology. And that's becoming less of an obvious boundary now, and there's a blurring between those two worlds. And we're starting to see major financial firms sort of entering the race to launch sort of safe custody services for digital assets. And we're starting to see various firms take an interest in cryptocurrencies themselves and starting to understand whether there's opportunities around exchanges, funds, custody service position. And we're seeing regulators and politicians really trying to balance their sort of mandate between investor consumer protection, but at the same time, they don't want to kill innovation. So there's a lot of things all moving in different directions, a lot of moving parts, but a huge amount of activity from all sorts of participants.
And that's Pete Stevens bringing us to the end of this 203rd edition of the Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via your preferred platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.